Welcome to Science Fiction 101, the podcast series where we explore the science fiction field from all angles, covering the past, the present, and the future. We're your hosts. I'm Phil.
And I'm Colin.
And we are 1 year old. It's official. We're a bouncing little baby at this point.
Wow. A brand new little baby podcast.
Yeah. And we've just looking at how many episodes we've done, I do remember at the very beginning, I was sort of numbering each episode as we recorded. And then I started saying, oh, I can't be bothered to count them anymore. But obviously putting them online for people to listen to, I have had to actually number them. And I realised we've done more than one a month, which is not bad going. Because when we set out doing this, I kind of wanted to do it like every 2 or 3 weeks. And I feared that we might only be able to do it about once a month. But we've actually managed more than once a month. So I think that's a fairly decent schedule. Probably quite a long gap between this one and the previous one we did, because we've both had COVID.
Yes.
Are you recovered now, Colin?
No, I am still not all the way recovered yet. And so I apologize to our listeners for any sniffles or coughs which make it through the edit. But I'm going to enjoy that deep bass tone in my voice for as long as I have it.
That's the one benefit of it. But yeah, we both went down with COVID totally independently because, as some listeners may know, I'm in the UK and Colin is on the west coast of the US. So, you know, we couldn't really be much further apart.
No, and there's no evidence of digital transmission for this virus yet.
Absolutely not. Last time, but it seems a lifetime ago, I think we reviewed All Judgment Fled.
We did. That was a good book.
It was a good book. And we got some comments from listeners, as we often do. One was, one listener pointed out that when I reeled off a list of British science fiction writers of the 1960s, I didn't mention John Brunner. And yeah, that's a real slap on the wrists for me, because I should have done. John Brunner was one of the most significant British science fiction writers. And he really emerged in the 1960s. So apologies to John Brunner. He's probably turning in his grave right now. We also heard from Caroline Mullen, who very kindly sent a PDF of a talk that she gave at NovaCon 50, a science fiction convention, and all about James White and his work. So that was fantastic to receive. And thank you very much, Caroline, for sending that through to us. And Caroline also referred us to a couple of PhDs that discuss James White. Not exclusively James White, but he gets some good coverage. One is Jack Fennell's thesis, Irish Science Fiction. And the other one is called Space for Peace, Fragments of the Irish Troubles in the Science Fiction of Bob Shaw and James White. Those do sound very intriguing, and if and when I get some time, I'll go digging into those.
Do you have special access to PhDs that, say, people across the continent and the ocean wouldn't have, or do you just have to know where to look?
It's a bit of both. There are some public repositories. In general, nowadays, if somebody writes a PhD thesis, it tends to be put in a public place where anyone can see it. It's part of the new open scholarship that we're all engaged in these days. Older ones, you sometimes do have to have an academic library account to be able to get to them. Something else that Caroline Mullen mentioned to me is that she had passed a note of our podcast to James White's daughter. And Caroline says, I think she'll be pleased to hear of your work. So that's very nice. I like it when we make contact with people. That's very good.
Yeah, I like that too. Well, especially when we can point people to great science fiction that has maybe fallen out of the popular venue, isn't thought about or read very often, but should be, because it was good.
Yeah, it's all very easy reviewing the latest thing and the latest fad, and we've done a bit of that ourselves, but actually teasing out little gems that other people don't know about is all good stuff, I think.
Yeah, we may be doing that later today.
We may, and we'll come to that shortly. A couple of things from our Science Fiction 101 Facebook page in response to All Judgment Fled. One commenter said that it was one of his favourite stories, although he did wonder why they used two separate Apollo ships in the story. Do you remember that? In the book, there are two of these sort of Apollo capsules that go off to investigate the alien presence.
Yes.
And I think the discussion that then followed on Facebook was to the effect of, well, it sort of adds to the drama, gives more flexibility to the storytelling and all of that. And then somebody called Colin Cuskey commented, I feel like we should start a list of things that science fiction teaches NASA. And then at the beginning of the list, three items, although only two of them are filled in. One is things that science fiction teaches NASA. One, extra spacesuits. Two, extra communication methods that don't depend on the MAV. I can't remember what the MAV was. What's the MAV?
Oh, MAV, the Mars Ascent Vehicle from The Martian.
Of course, yes. And item three, you put question mark. So I think it's fill in the blanks, isn't it? I think we should have that as a running list on our website that gradually gets longer and longer as people send us more suggestions.
Definitely. Oh, I should rewatch Space Cowboys. I know there's going to be something in there that NASA should be keeping around.
Oh, definitely. I think the mere existence of things like that is science fiction telling NASA, don't ever use cowboys. or what was the other one? Armageddon. Don't use retired miners.
Oh, yeah. Oof.
So having reviewed All Judgment Fled, we obviously were thinking in terms of rhyme for this episode because we decided that we would review All Systems Red. Do you see it rhymes? All Systems Red, All Judgment Fled. There's something in the air, isn't there? All Systems Red is by Martha Wells and is part of the Murderbot series. And one of our listeners suggested that we should cover this. And Colin's mentioned it before, because Colin is now officially known as a Murderbot fiend, because I said he was that on Facebook.
Yes, it goes on my business cards now.
Whereas I am a Murderbot novice. The only piece of the Murderbot series I've read is this first story, All Systems Red. So we're coming at this from two different angles. One from somebody who's read a lot of it and knows the whole context as currently published, I suppose, and one as somebody who's just reading it as a story in isolation. The story, for those who don't know, All Systems Red won the Hugo Award and the Nebula Award, so it was awarded by both fans and professional writers, and other items in the series have done the same thing, won multiple awards, so it is a very highly regarded series. How did you first get into the Murderbot series, Colin?
Every month, Tor Books sends out a free ebook to anyone that signed up to their list. Mm-hmm. And that was one of those downloads. And so Every month I faithfully download it. I stick it in my Dropbox directory. And most of them I come back around to at some point. Mm-hmm. I still think I have many that I haven't read yet because they've been doing this for a number of years.
Yeah.
But this was a short little one. I read it and really, really enjoyed it. And then learned that there was a series built on it and have read all the books as they've been coming out.
So the first one was a freebie, but then you liked it so much that you bought the follow-ups.
I tend to library before I buy, just to be frugal.
Yeah. Now, I'd heard about this series because I'd seen it appearing in lists of best of the year and award-winning lists and that kind of thing. But I, as I've alluded to in previous episodes, I've got a really long backlog of reading. And finally, I thought, let's give it a go. And the fact that the opening story is a novella, so it's not a full-length novel, that kind of chimes with what I like to read. I seem to get on better with shorter works than longer works. What do we think of All Systems Red? Is it a good opening to the series?
Yes. Yeah, I'm going to say pretty conclusively yes. No, it's definitely science fiction, but it almost falls into the page-turner genre, where there's lots of things happening all the time.
Have you found that the world of Murderbot has become richer? Has your understanding of the Murderbot character become deeper? Or is it simply different adventures of Murderbot in different places?
To me, one of the attractions of Murderbot is the fact that we're not talking about a human character. We're talking about something that's partially human, created by humans. Yeah. So there's all these other related issues, like should this being have freedom and self and to be able to exercise its self-will? Mm-hmm. How do we relate to something that isn't like us yeah. totally, but is related to us and similar and very in several ways?
Yeah,
And it's all told from Murderbot's perspective. In fact, the character does not really have a name because it was created as a piece yes. of equipment to go along to protect colonists on expeditions and journeys and business interactions as well.
And in fact, the term Murderbot, at least from All Systems Red, which is the only one I've read so far, the term Murderbot is a name that the character gives to itself, but I don't think anybody else knows that, do they?
It's its own private nickname, yeah. And it was revealed to several of the other people in the first story by accident. And that scene is one of the coolest things about the series, because it tells you a lot about Murderbot. Murderbot tries to project this image of safeness and invincibility so that it can fulfill its mission of protecting people down on this planet. Mm-hmm. And yet inside, in its heart, in its soul, it's very insecure and very private and very protective of itself and its rights.
Mm.
So the one thing that we haven't mentioned yet is that through a combination of software and hardware, all these bots are controlled by a governor and an external system. And if it goes against the wishes of the system and the people that own it, maybe not the people that rent it or are using it at the time, then it's punished.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. And through a failure of its governing module, it ends up killing a bunch of people. Yeah. And to prevent that from ever happening again, it hacks its own governing module to get free will.
Yeah, and that's how we meet Murderbot in the first story, isn't it? That we learn fairly early on, I think in the first paragraph, actually, that the governor module has been turned off. We don't know exactly what that is at that point, but it becomes clear through the story that it is this sort of controlling part of the physicality of the unit. I really don't know what to call it. And I've noticed when other people talk about it, they do refer to Murderbot as an it. Mm-hmm. And when you're reading the story, you are conscious that it is an it, because it's all told in the first person. The character refers to itself as I, as it would. The other characters, I think, tend to refer to it as a he or as an it. But as you're reading it, you're thinking, well, I still don't quite know what you are. I know that you are part machine and you are part human. You are part computer and you are part organic. And there's the fact that it's told from the limited point of view of the character itself means that we don't know everything about it. And I find that quite a fascinating strategy for storytelling. If the author had chosen to write it in a more objective, external narration, you know, a third-person narration, we might have gone more into the objective reality of what Murderbot is. But everything we get is coming from Murderbot itself. So you've got questions of whether it is a reliable or an unreliable narrator, for example.
Oh, yeah. You could probably definitely call into question its choice of media. Yeah, it's openly dismissive of gender right. and sexual and physical relations. Yeah. And that comes from two areas, I think. One is that it doesn't have any. Mm-hmm. And the second is that there are sex bots. And those sex bots have even less free will than it has. And so it does not want to fall into that category.
What I found quite fascinating about it is the way that they're kind of background issues. You know, they're, as far as I could tell, at least from All Systems Red, the story isn't directly about the free will or determinism of Murderbot. It's there is an actual plot. You know, there's the mechanics of a story going on, and that's what the story is about. But in getting this kind of adventure story told, we are getting into questions of free will, to what extent Murderbot is allowed to think the way it wants to and do the things it wants to. Notably, to me, it likes nothing more than to watch soap operas. So, from which it seems to learn quite a lot about humanity, some of which obviously is going to be totally wrong and distorted, but it seems to know that as well. It seems to know the difference between reality and the soap opera world. What I don't know is, was Murderbot always this? Or was Murderbot born a human and modified? Was Murderbot made as a kind of a robot and then human parts added to it? Or is this a kind of a multi-generational thing where they're built and raised as this? How does the individual life cycle of one of these units work? I don't know that from this first story. Do you know it from the later stories?
No. And I think that's one of the real skills that Martha Wells brings into this, is that she only talks about the level of detail she needs to tell the story with the characters right now.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so in future future episodes, future versions, future books of this, it gives her an incredible amount of flexibility. She's never locked into handling something she doesn't want to handle later.
Right.
And yeah. And this is something she talked about in her writing, is she tends to be very spur of the moment. She's not a planner. She tends to like go along with the character in their journeys and adventures, and she brings in just the things she needs to do with what's happening right now.
Did she know it was going to be a series when she started?
I don't think so. I wish I had spent more time trying to read about the creation of Murderbot. Mm. So let's talk a little bit about Martha Wells from the little that I do know. Mm. So she has been an author for quite a while and broke into, you know, I'm going to say massive popularity with the Murderbot Diaries series.
Yeah.
Was mainly known for writing fantasy books. Yes. And so, you know, for this completely other new kind of a thing, science fiction, it's almost, I don't want to say out of character, because, you know, good authors can write lots of things very well.
Mm.
And I had a very, very brief Twitter conversation with her.
Oh, fantastic.
So I thought, wow, wouldn't it be nice to have a Rise and Fall of Sanctuary Moon t-shirt? So that's the soap opera that Murderbot likes. She has said it's kind of based in the same genre as How to Get Away with Murder, which is on the American Broadcasting System right now.
Yeah.
And so I went and searched around, and of course, you can find lots of these t-shirts. And then I remembered about the rampant IP theft that tends to happen on Etsy and many of these other sites. And so I tweeted at her, and I said, hey, I really enjoy your work. I was wondering if any of the Sanctuary Moon t-shirts that I'm finding online, if they're legitimate or not. And both she and her husband tweeted back to me and told me, no, everything you're finding is all illegal. The only valid thing is on the World Builder site, where they, as one of their fundraising efforts, made a book plate. And she liked the book plate so much that they made it into a t-shirt that you can go buy.
Oh, well, it's good that there is something out there, because that's the thing with the illegal stuff, is it's usually filling a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fans want something, but there is no official version out there. What I find interesting about Murderbot as a character is that there is clearly a personal backstory to the character, which, from all systems read, I don't know that backstory, but I've got some very strong tantalizing clues of something. So, for example, the fact that Murderbot has killed, what, 57 people in some incident in the past, but it's not explained, not within that story, but I imagine maybe one of the sequel stories goes into that. So there's a personal backstory that is implied, and it's intriguing. There is a societal backstory, in that clearly this isn't just one unit that exists. There is a whole network of these things. There's these whole, is it called a hub system? And there's a technological backstory. which again we don't know much about. And then there is this, for me, the big mystery of how did this all get started? You know, where does this begin? And then it also ties in with a lot of tropes from science fiction. People who are bred to be soldiers, for example, or bred to be warriors. We've had before robots that are made to be warriors. And also throughout the whole history of science fiction, we've had robots that either obey laws set by humans or disobey the laws. And those, of course, have been codified as Asimov's laws of robotics.
Yes.
So this story, All Systems Red, is playing with a lot of pre-existing tropes. And it is doing it in a very deft way. And to learn that the writer actually has spent a lifetime writing a totally different kind of fantasy fiction is quite an amazing revelation. That explains why they're such a good storyteller, but it does make you wonder why that sudden shift to science fiction.
Should do some more digging to see what she's done in interviews.
Yeah.
We should also say, or could also say, that you know her series is so popular that she has, for the last 2 years, turned down Hugo and Nebula nominations because she's felt like her work has been already very well recognized. Yeah. And wants to give room for other people to be recognized, which I think says a lot about her.
Yeah, I think that's a very gracious thing to do. And it has meant that more people have ended up on the shortlist for some of those awards, hasn't it? Mm-hmm. From your reading of the series so far, what would you say is the best single piece? Is it this first story or is it one of the other stories?
I think my favorite one is probably Network Effect, which is the first novel. So there are three novels, or three novellas, two short stories that were published online, and then two novels.
Okay, yeah.
Fugitive Telemetry and Network Effect, like I mentioned.
Does it work at longer lengths, then? I mean, is the novel episodic, like it's a series of shorter pieces joined together, or is it a fully-fledged novel?
No, it's a fully-fledged novel.
Mm.
Yeah, it's just the scope of things has been expanded, and the requirements to achieve the initial plot are more involved. In the second book, we meet an artificial intelligence that's part of a transport, and that transport becomes a character in Network Effect.
Ah, okay, yeah, that was something I wondered about. All Systems Red is whether the other characters come back. Because it does seem at the end of the story that Murderbot has gone off somewhere else. And it's as if we'll never see those characters again. Do any of them come back?
Yes, all of them do.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's, to me, that was one of the really interesting things about All Conditions Red. So Murderbot is illegal. As company property, it has hacked itself so that it has free will and free action. And it is desperately trying to hide this because it does not want to go back under the control of the company. And as a quick aside, the company is never named because Murderbot has hacked itself that whenever the name of the company is mentioned, it's erased and replaced by the words "the company" in its thought stream and in its records so that it can't ever be traced back to where it came from. But yeah, so you would think the happy ending of this story is that the Murderbot finds a home where it can be itself in free will. And when presented with that choice, it distrusts humans so much, it runs away. Because it's going to train, it's going to train being owned by somebody to being in the guardianship of someone. And it does not see a large distinction in that because of the behavior of humans.
Yeah, and therein lies one of the sort of inherent contradictions in the character. And I don't mean that in a bad way, I mean this in a really good way. Is that the character, the Murderbot character, it is constantly, it seems to me, in the first story, is constantly defending and saving and protecting humans. So it is sort of fulfilling its mission. But at the same time, it doesn't really seem to care about humans. So it implies there is some deep conflict within the character that maybe the character isn't totally aware of.
Yeah, you know, on the one hand, it wants free will. On the other hand, in order to maintain the appearance of being controlled, it has to do the things that we find admirable, right? It's protecting people and saving mm-hmm. people. And yet, whenever it's given an opportunity to make a choice between saving, doing the very little, least it needs to do to save and protect people, and doing the honorable and just thing, it always chooses the honorable and just thing. And that is shown right in the opening episode. So in the story opens, it's protecting a bunch of people on a planet in exploration, and it has been rented to them. Now remember, it's considered a piece of property, and that's what it does. It goes and it protects people, and if it gets destroyed, that's okay, we have more of them. Its method of fighting and protection is literally to throw itself into the middle of combat, where it can take up to 60-70% of damage, having its body destroyed, because it can always be rebuilt in a little reparation room.
Yeah.
And one of the scientists is attacked, completely out of surprise, and has to be carried out of this crater. And in the process of doing that, it has to go past another scientist who is in danger of being hurt if this animal comes back. And it's being advised by the hub system, ignore that one that isn't hurt, get the one that is hurt out of there. And Murderbot stops and talks to the second scientist, helps the scientist stand up, and escorts it out while it's carrying this other scientist that's bleeding.
Some of the moments where the other characters kind of take against Murderbot are quite moving, I think. There is a sense that, again, it feels like there's a backstory, but there is a sense that these units are frequently abused by humans. They're certainly seen as either non-human or subhuman, even though they clearly have a human component to them. Mm-hmm. And some of the characters, it does vary from character to character, but some of the characters are really sort of openly hostile to the Murderbot character, while others are more willing to give it a chance and to weigh up, well, it's done this bad thing, but it's also done these good things here, and I think we can trust it. Whereas others will say, no, they've done these bad things, and therefore we can't trust it. So there's always that kind of, again, it's a kind of a tension that always makes you wonder whether this character can be relied on in the future. My sense is it must be reliable and ultimately a character that we can root for, because otherwise this series can't really sustain. I think we do feel for the character. Does that change through the rest of the series, do you think? I mean, do we remain sympathetic to the Murderbot character?
Yes, I would say so. I did. Yeah, there are anti-heroes that come around, but I don't think Murderbot falls into that category.
Right.
Well, as someone that normally reads older science fiction, how did you find the science fiction?
I found this one actually to feel quite traditional. It really did feel like traditional science fiction. The only thing that made it feel modern, although I wouldn't necessarily say 21st century, but what made it feel like a more modern piece than an older piece is the constant reference to the company. In that sense, Murderbot feels modern, but not hugely modern. It didn't feel like this couldn't have been written in the 90s, really. I suppose some of the discussion of the sort of architecture of the computer control system sounds like something from the post-internet era. So I doubt that this story would have worked back in the 80s, but it could have been written in the 90s or any point after that, I think. So it feels slightly modern, but I think it does feel very traditional. The idea of exploring planets, different expeditions to planets, having robots to assist you, because that's essentially what Murderbot is, even though it's got a human component, it is a kind of a robot. It does feel really quite traditional to me. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I agree with you in a lot of ways. I think if you took companies out and replaced them with governments, mm-hmm. and how those governments, you know, compete and fight against one another, that would fall right in line with earlier science fiction.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess written science fiction has been using sort of companies and commercial concerns for a very long time. You know, Robert Heinlein in the 1940s, I think, was having companies send people to the moon and out into space. So, you know, it's not it's not a hugely novel concept in terms of science fiction literature. What I liked in the writing of All Systems Red is that it's a breeze of a read. It's because it's all told subjectively by the central character, it just bounces along. You know, it's not one of those works that stops to give you a philosophical underpinning or lecture, which, you know, in recent times we've read some things by Arthur C. Clarke and we've sort of noticed how he sort of lectures at you from time to time. But this just sort of bounces along quite nicely. And it does feel very much of a piece with the stuff that Andy Weir publishes, I think. It sort of feels unassuming and kind of thing that anybody could read. You know, you don't have to be hugely technical to understand it or anything like that. And I think that probably explains its popularity.
One of the things that strikes me about Murderbot is, while it's the protagonist, it has a very difficult time relating to humans. Yeah. There's lots of discussion about how it's used to traveling in the cargo part of the ship, and when it's ordered to be in the crew module, it's very uncomfortable.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
It prefers to have its face mask up because a lot of times it has visceral reactions to things the humans say or do, and it knows those would make the humans uncomfortable and perhaps tell them that it's not being controlled.
Yeah, yeah. I really like those aspects of it, actually. Those were... it sort of felt like parallels to slavery and racism, and that made it feel very real. I think if those elements weren't in there, it would perhaps feel even more like older science fiction. But the fact that we've got these sort of questions of identity going on for the character, and how other people perceive the protagonist's identity and all of that. Yeah, I thought all of that was quite rich stuff. But it seems that was just sort of bubbling under the surface. It wasn't what the story was about particularly, but it's part of the sort of the texture of what makes the story engaging, I think, for a modern reader.
Definitely.
So I presume you will carry on reading the series, won't you? You've found no reason to stop at this point.
No, you know, okay. I think that Murderbot has a lot more to tell me.
Yeah.
And I'm interested to you know, go along that journey with it. Although the last novel, Fugitive Telemetry, is actually set in the middle of the complete Murderbot timeline.
Ah, okay.
So the first novels literally go back to back.
Yeah.
The first three novellas do. And then there's the first novel, and then the last novel, the one that was most recently published, is actually set in between, I want to say, 4 and 5. Yeah. And it's a bit of a murder mystery.
Interesting. And I might have already asked this, but are they all told from Murderbot's perspective?
Yes, with the exception of one short story, which is told from the perspective of the lady who is in charge of Preservation Ox.
That's not Mensa, is it, from that first story?
Yes, Dr. Mensa.
Dr. Mensa, yeah. I'm not sure whether I will read any more. I can imagine that I might read some of the shorter pieces. Although I like it, and I think it's a very, very nimble and deft piece of science fiction, and I certainly will recommend All Systems Red to other people, I didn't feel compelled to need to know what's going to happen next at the end of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What I do feel compelled to know is what had happened previously. I'd like to know how we got here. So if there is a story in the sequence that goes into the origins of Murderbot, I would be interested in that, I think. So I guess what I'm saying is that I'd go for a prequel, but I'm not particularly interested in a sequel.
Hmm.
Is there a prequel?
Not per se. One of the short stories is definitely a prequel.
Okay.
But the sequel to All Conditions Red, Murderbot goes to explore its origin.
Ah, okay.
It finds that it needs to know why it killed those 57 people.
Yes.
And it attempts to go find out if it's capable of such a thing again or if it was beyond its control.
I think I am going to have to read that one.
Yeah. Although most of the other things that you're asking about, like, you know, what is the nature of security bots and sex bots and constructs, those things aren't ever answered. You know, even things like which parts of Murderbot are organic and which parts are inorganic, those are never really fully answered. Some of them get answered in passing, like in Rogue Protocol. We learn that most of its skeleton is inorganic. I guess that's also part of the mystique of Murderbot is, you know, trying to suss out those details so that we understand more about Murderbot.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What are we going to learn about it?
Yeah. Anything else you want to say about the Murderbot series? Would you heartily recommend it to people?
Oh yeah, yeah. Especially I would just read the first three novellas and then decide if you want to continue on in the series from there.
That sounds like a plan.
You know, since we were talking about bots, I may have, with the assistance of Mr. Seth Heasley, come up with a bot quiz for you.
Oh, no. This was unplanned and unannounced.
Oh, that's right. I didn't. I'm going to blame it on the COVID. This is short. There are 11 questions.
Okay.
I will give you the name of a robot or artificial intelligence. And you can tell me the name of the television series or movie that it comes from.
Okay.
Here, we'll start with an easy one, I hope. Dr. Roger Corby.
Dr. Roger Corby, I believe, is a Star Trek character.
Exactly. Which series of Star Trek are we talking about?
Original series. And if you give me a few seconds, I'll be able to pull the title of the episode to the forefront of my mind. I'm trying to remember which one it is. Is it the one called What Are Little Girls Made Of?
Exactly.
Hey, written by Robert Block, author of Psycho.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
Interesting.
Yeah, he wrote about three episodes of Star Trek. They were heavily rewritten because I don't think he was really the best writer for that series. But that was probably his best episode.
Hmm. Okay, good job. Here's one. Whopper.
Could you spell that for me, please?
W-O-P-R.
I should know that. Could I have a clue?
This was a movie from the 1980s, starring Matthew Broderick and Barry Corbin.
I can picture it. I'm struggling for the title. Is it Short Circuit?
No.
War Games?
War Games.
Now, you see, I didn't think there was a robot in there. Or is this the computer system?
That's the artificial intelligence.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Would you like to play a game?
Oh, yes.
All right. Well, you're 2 for 2 so far. Good job. The next one is Battlin Maxo.
Oh, my word. You'll have to spell that one for me as well.
B-A-T-T-L-I-N apostrophe, so short for battling.
I see.
And Maxo, M-A-X-O.
That doesn't ring any bells at all, so it probably means it's from a film that I haven't seen.
It might have been from a television series you may have seen.
Television series I may have seen.
And it's a book that I would... It would be in a book collection of short stories that I hope you have read.
More clues. Give me more clues.
Okay. The movie starred Hugh Jackman.
No, I'm going to have to give up on that one. Sorry.
That is the Twilight Zone episode Steel.
Oh. Yeah, it's the name of it in the movie, but that's not the name of it in the original episode, is it? Or short story. Is it? Or is it?
Yeah.
Wow. Do you know what I'm doing? I'm just looking in my Twilight Zone Companion by Mark Scott Zickrey, and I'm gonna read up on that.
The episode's called Steel, S-T-E-E-L, and That's a Matheson story, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It's in page 380 of the Twilight Zone Companion. Here we go. Oh, you're absolutely right. They in the book, the Twilight Zone Companion, Mark Scott Zikri begins every entry on each episode with the Rod Serling voiceover intro. And this one begins with Serling saying, "Sports item, circa 1974, battling Maxo, B2, heavyweight, blah, 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 blah." So, yeah. Wow. I thought that was an unnamed robot. I hang my head in shame for not knowing that one.
Oh, that's okay. We'll get you a new one. Now, the name of this robot is hardly unique. Mm-hmm. However, the character is just called The Robot.
Well, the first thing that springs to mind is Lost in Space.
That's exactly right.
Uh-huh. And, yes. Of course, the original Lost in Space robot was clearly related to Robbie the Robot from Forbidden Planet. And the explanation for that is that they were both designed by the same person.
Really?
Yeah.
The next robot is Rosie the Robot.
Rosie the Robot. Is that the Jetsons?
It is. Despite having the same last name, I don't think those two robots are related.
I have a fascinating fact about the Jetsons. Did you know that this year, 2022, George Jetson will be born?
No way!
Yeah, apparently. Because there's an episode, of, apparently, where somebody says something about living to the age of 140. And he says... something like, well, that means I'd have to live another 100 years from where I am now, which means he is 40 at the time of the episode, and it's established what year the episode is in. And when you do the maths, it turns out that he must be born in 2022. So there you go.
Wow.
So watch out for that.
Well, the other important thing to know about 2022 is that's the year that Make Room is set in. So yes. Be careful about what you eat.
Yes, I'm feeling like some Soylent Green right now.
Oh. Okay, the next robot or artificial intelligence is M5.
Now, is this from television?
It is.
Is this another Star Trek reference?
It is.
Is this the ultimate computer?
It is the ultimate computer, but it will never replace a good captain.
No, never.
Okay, I have another five for you. Johnny 5.
Johnny 5. Now, that one I should know, but I'm struggling to picture Johnny 5. Is this from TV?
No, this is a movie.
Then I either need a clue or I have to give up.
You mentioned the name of this movie earlier in this quiz.
Oh, is it Short Circuit?
It is Short Circuit.
Ah, of course, yeah.
Now, I stretched this one a little bit. The name of this robot is Grandmother.
Grandmother. Is Grandmother electric by any chance?
She is quite electric.
Now, this could be a reference to a TV film called The Electric Grandmother, or it could be a reference to a Twilight Zone episode called I Sing the Body Electric, or it could be a reference to a Ray Bradbury short story called I Sing the Body Electric. All of which are really, they're the same thing.
They are the same thing, yeah. Yeah, I found that a fabulous short story to read.
Oh, really? I don't like it.
Oh!
No, it's one of those that sort of represents all the bad things that people say about Bradbury. Most of the bad things people say about Bradbury aren't true. But, you know, people say, oh, he's over-sentimental. And if you look at that story, yeah, he is. He doesn't really bother with explaining how things work. And if you look at that story, yeah, it's true. Mm-hmm. So, oh, and the other thing is people say, oh, he's too flowery with his writing. He's not direct enough with his storytelling. And if you look at that story, it's true. So, I mean, it's not a bad story in itself.
Okay. Next robot, LOL.
Can you spell it for me? I think I know what it is.
L-A-L.
Yeah. Is this Data's daughter from Star Trek The Next Generation?
Yes, it is.
Hey, I don't know the name of the episode, though.
The Offspring.
Ah, okay.
All right. Next pair of robots, Roy Batty and Pris.
These are from Blade Runner.
I struggled with this one because I don't know if they're actually mechanical robots or if they're synthetic humans or what they are. But they're definitely artificial intelligences.
Yes. They're androids, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. And, okay, the last one, Sunny and Vicky.
Sunny and Vicky. How are you spelling Sunny?
S-O-N-N-Y.
Sunny and Vicky. Could I have a clue, please?
Sunny is an NS5.
Ooh.
Created by Dr. Alfred Lanning.
Oh, this must be iRobot?
It is.
Is this the film iRobot or the book?
The film.
Yeah, I don't remember the film too well. I think I've seen it twice and didn't really like it that much.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to believe it's based on the book iRobot. It's a variation of the classic closed room murder.
It's not a bad film in itself, but and as I say, I've seen it twice, so I wouldn't have watched it a second time if it was terrible. But it's not a patch on what it could have been. And this, I think, is the curse of those of us who are interested in adaptation. We know what these things could be.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you quizzed very well today. 10 out of 11.
I don't know how I managed that. With a lot of clues and a following wind, I think, is how that came about. So, I've got a couple of items under past, present and future. I've got a nice one for past science fiction, but it also counts as present because it's a new release. The British Film Institute has recently, in the last couple of weeks, finally released a Blu-ray and a DVD version of a 1950s BBC television production of 1984. And this was the first television adaptation of 1984, George Orwell's famous novel. And it starred Peter Cushing, and it was scripted by Nigel Neal, who is famous for the Quatermass series, and produced by Rudolf Cartier, who was one of the most creative producers and directors of British drama television in the 1950s. This is something that was done live. It's from the days of live television. But
wow.
Rudolf Cartier, part of his approach was to make a lot of use of film. So although it was done live in a TV studio, a number of scenes were pre-filmed. So on the night of the live performance, you know, the actors would act out the live bits and then the pre-filmed bits would be played in. And now the recording of this is actually, it's what's variously called a kinescope or a tele-recording, which basically means back in the day, before there was any videotape, what you had to do is you had to take a film camera and point it at a TV screen and film the screen. That was the only way of recording these things for posterity.
Wow. So
they did two performances of it. The first one I don't think was recorded, but they did a repeat performance within a week, I think, and that was filmed. It was tele-recorded. And the film has survived. It has been broadcast on BBC TV a couple of times in the intervening years, so I've seen it and I've recorded it off-air, so I've got a recording of it myself. But some years ago, the BFI were going to release it on DVD, but it was blocked by the Orwell estate because they didn't have permission, and the Orwell estate would not give permission for it to be released. But this year, in the UK at least, all of George Orwell's works dropped out of copyright because the copyright period has expired. So now the BFI was free to release this Blu-ray and DVD, and they put some new materials on there, so it's not the release that there would have been a few years ago when they first attempted to do this. I haven't yet got my hands on a copy, but I've read some reviews and it sounds like a very fantastic presentation. I'm fascinated by the technology of all of this stuff, partly because that's what I do for a profession, you know, I'm involved in film and TV. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing in the way that this has been presented on the Blu-ray and the DVD is they have scanned the film recording of the complete show, but they have also got hold of the original film inserts that were played into the live recording. And those were shot on 35mm film, and they're pristine quality because, you know, they're the original bits of film out of the camera, essentially.
Right.
And so on the Blu-ray, as you're watching it, as I say, I haven't seen it yet, but as you're watching it, it will go from the studio stuff, which will look a bit fuzzy, but then it'll go to a scene that's shot on film, and that looks like, you know, a pristine piece of film, all in black and white, of course. But, you know, they've made the very best of the materials available. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that. I'm not sure if it's going to be available in the US, because apparently George Orwell's works are still copyrighted in the US, because you have a different copyright system over there. But
yeah. Which year was it written in? Do you remember off the top of your head?
The book was published in 49, I think. 48 or 49. And Orwell died a few years after that. And it's the, in the UK, it's how long has the author been dead is what determines whether a work is still in copyright. Mm-hmm. And that period has now elapsed. Because George Orwell died relatively young, his works have gone into the public domain quicker than, you know, if he'd lived another 20 years. So that I was offering that as a past item. Have you got any past items, Colin?
I don't. All of my media and book consumption has been comfort reading while I was sick. But I found this very, what I found to be a very interesting science fiction series on the Disney Channel.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Parallels. Yeah. It's French science fiction, really in the young adult genre, mm-hmm. which was nice to have something, you know, light and, you know, science fiction-y to watch.
Yeah.
It reminded me of Michael Burstein's science fiction, where he talks about the effect of the Large Hadron Collider.
Oh, yes.
And parallel worlds.
Yeah.
So there's some parallel worlds, there's some time travel. Very interesting. I enjoyed it.
And were you watching that with subtitles, or is it a dubbed version?
It's dubbed over.
Okay.
And I've watched enough media to where I very quickly pick up on lip sync issues.
Mm.
And so first I thought, oh, the synchronization of the audio for this is horrible. And then I realize what their lips are doing and what their sounds are making don't jive at all. It's not a delay. And so then I realized it's French.
Yeah.
And that was interesting to me because, again, right, in the United States, most of our media is completely domestic. Mm-hmm. A lot of our television does come from Canada, but to get science fiction from France or Spain or even Mexico just does not happen as often as it really should, probably.
I think that's one of the benefits of the streaming age, you know, of Netflix and all the other streaming services. There is much more international material being released. Some of the most successful things on Netflix have been foreign language, foreign to us.
So, oh, yeah, The Squid Game.
Yeah, that's a classic example. Yeah, I'll have to look out for Parallels. I've not seen that one. Another past item, while I had COVID, I found it very difficult to concentrate on reading, so I didn't get much reading done, but I did watch a few things, and one of the things I watched was the 1959 film On the Beach, which is based on the Neville Shute novel. And if people don't know about On the Beach, it's a post-apocalyptic novel, so it's set after some really unspecified Third World War, and basically it's set in Australia, and the Third World War has really taken place in the Northern Hemisphere, and all of civilization in Europe and North America and Russia, all of it is wiped out by atomic war. People in Australia have survived, but the world is now enmeshed in radiation, which is slowly creeping south. So the people in Australia are not long for this world. So it's a bit of a downer as a story. But just like when the pandemic began, I felt the need to go and read stories and watch films about pandemics. Now we've got the war in Ukraine. I feel like watching some World War III dramas. But On the Beach stood up better than I expected it to. I've seen it before. It is quite a slow film. It's certainly not an action-packed film. It's more a film of character than anything else. I still kind of fall asleep at the same point in the film as I have on every previous viewing. So there is something that is just not right with the pacing of it. But it struck me as a much better film than I remember it being. And it's out on Blu-ray. And so I recommend people have a look at that. I also started rereading the novel as well, but I haven't got very far with that. Have you ever seen it or read it?
No. Between the heaviness of American politics and then the pandemic, I had begged off for things that were really down, because there's enough down in my life right now. I'm looking for more things that are hopeful and uplifting and that buoy me through these times. Although, you know, we're starting to crawl out from underneath a lot of that, so I might be ready to do that this year.
A couple of other random things. I've recently been on a couple of other podcasts. I was interviewed for a podcast called Words to Write By, which is really aimed at people who are looking for advice and guidance on creative writing. And I was interviewed about a book that Ray Bradbury wrote called Zen and the Art of Writing. So that was quite interesting, and I've been listening to their podcast as well, where they discuss different methods of motivating yourself as a writer and all of that. So anyone who's listening to this who's a creative writer, I'd recommend Words to Write By, not just because I was in an episode, but because it's quite good. And I was also on Continuum Drag, which reviews, well, they don't say this, but I say this, they review bad TV science fiction. And so they go digging in the archives and looking for old stuff from the 70s and the 60s and more recent stuff as well. And they've done a three-parter. Well, at the time of recording this, they're two-thirds of the way through the 1980 Martian Chronicles TV miniseries. And they asked me to join them for one of their episodes. So it's quite fun, Continuum Drag, because they can find the humour in everything, which I think you have to do if you're reviewing some bad stuff. I think you have to be able to find the humour in it. But nevertheless, they're quite spot on with their assessments. So Continuum Drag's a good one to listen to if you're interested in old science fiction films and TV.
Good to know.
Yeah. I think that's all I've got, Colin. Have you got anything else for today?
So for my other podcast, Take Me to Your Reader, where we talk about adapted science fiction, next month we're looking forward to the release of the new adaptation of Firestarter by Stephen King. So it'll be interesting to see what, you know, 40 years of time and better special effects and, you know, changes in culture will do to that story and the adaptation of it.
When you say changes of culture, what are you hinting at there?
I don't know. I don't know what to expect for this new one.
Okay.
It's really a story about a little girl and her dad.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder, you know, will the mom have a little more forward effect aside from just being there as window dressing? Or, it's just interesting to see what's different about it. Maybe not a lot. Maybe a whole bunch.
I don't know that I've ever read or seen Firestarter. It's one of those things where I think I know it, but when I think, when did I ever watch that then? I don't remember ever watching it. What often happened back in the day, sort of in the 80s and 90s, is that I was constantly reading magazines like Starlog and Cine Fantastique. So I was quite well informed about all the films and TV stuff that was being made. But I didn't necessarily get to see all of it, because it didn't all come to the to the cinemas near me, kind of thing.
Right.
So there's lots of... I was thinking the other day, there was a film that was on the cover of Starlog, and it was called Heart Beeps. And I don't know if you've ever come across that.
No.
I think it had Andy Kaufman in it. And it's about robots. But I've never seen it. It literally has never passed in front of me. It's never been on British TV, as far as I've seen. I don't think I've ever seen a DVD of it. But it was important enough at the time to get the cover of Starlog. So I knew about it, And yeah, I've never had the opportunity to see it. I gather it's terrible, but...
oh, yeah. It's in a rare club on Rotten Tomatoes. Zero.
Really?
Oh. Zero ratings from six... Yeah.
Wow.
From six different critics.
I would like to see it just to see how bad it could possibly be. Anything else?
No.
Then I think we're probably done for today. So, thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time. We're Phil Nichols and Colin Kusky. Our theme tune is from purpleplanet.com. Look for the show notes on our website at 101sf.blogspot.com, and also find us as Science Fiction 101 on Facebook. And finally, please follow us or subscribe to us on your podcast app. You'll find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Listen Notes, Amazon Music, Audible, or wherever you get your podcasts.